Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Last week's talk, I was making the connection between the states of samadhi and the arising of insight, and that's especially concerning the insights which lead to enlightenment. But nevertheless, those insights are built up gradually as we cut away at the illusions which obsess our mind. And the path of insight doesn't sort of, as it were, begin after samadhi. It starts all the way along the path in the very, very beginning. And as we develop our alertness, awareness, our ability to reflect on what's going on in our mind. Because, again, it's not always you have the opportunity to gain deep samadhi. And it's coming soon to the end of this retreat in a couple of weeks' time. And you'll be able to use the abilities which you have gained in this retreat as perfect as we can possibly get it. It doesn't get better than this, so if it's not good enough, you're not going to get better than this. To be able to get the opportunities where you can calm the mind down and to be able to increase that power of mindfulness, to be more stable, to be more bright, to see deeply into what's going on inside. And as one develops this faculty of reflective awareness, and it's only half of mindfulness to be reflectively aware, the other half of mindfulness is remember how this all fits in, the aspect of wisdom which should always be going hand in hand with mindfulness. As one looks into this mind and sees the way it works with reflection, the stronger that mindfulness is and the more still, the more one sees, the more one understands, and the more powerful effect the mindfulness has. You start to see the way your mind works. And you can see some of the silliness and stupidity of that mind. The way it's reacting to things in an unskillful way. Unskillful in the sense of remembering that mindfulness also has the wisdom of the Buddhist path. It's not conducive to the path to liberation. It just is more conducive to the path of entanglement. Not freedom, but putting yourself more in prisons. So one looks at this mind more and more. The mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, more and more still. And you start to see things the way the mind works. One of the little sayings which has been in my mind the last week is that little saying which I wrote in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which I've been applying sort of much wider than I originally intended. In the booklet, it was, why allow what other people say to control your happiness? Why allow other people to control your happiness? Your happiness is your own concern. I've been extending that to say, why allow what happens in the world, what other people do, to affect your happiness? Extending that, why allow sickness in your own body to control your happiness? Why allow success or failure in your meditation, in what you are aiming for, to control your happiness? Why allow the moods of the mind to control your happiness? And you can understand that that particular way of looking at things is disassociating, you know, your inner happiness and freedom from the events of either the world, the events of your body, health and sickness, or even the events of your mind, to sort of letting go of all of that. Why allow that to manipulate and control your happiness? What you're doing is it's using like an insight, just a way of looking, just a paradigm, in order to lessen sort of the suffering of the moods of the mind, lessening the burdens of complexity of thinking and worrying, lessening all that busyness of our lives, all of that negativity sometimes, which ends up obstructing our time, our opportunity, our energies. which should be really focused on the goal. It's just too easy just to allow the things of the world, which are completely out of your control, or the health or sickness of your body, which is again completely out of control, or even the things which are in the mind, to allow them to make you unhappy. Why do you do that? So what's happening here is that whatever happens in that world, or the world outside, the world of your body or the world of your mind, you're beginning to get a sense of like letting go, abandoning the connection between the knower, the doer, sorry, the knower rather, and just what it knows. And again, as I mentioned in probably my first talk, it's what's in that space between the knower and the known, that where the hindrances and the defilements really work. I'm not saying that the knower is an entity or the known is something solid. This is just one way of looking at things. But in that particular way, that particular framework, it's useful because it really identifies and separates where the work of insight and meditation, where the work of development towards nibbana really takes place, in a space between the knower and the known. So what do you know right now? Not so much what you know, but how do you know it? What's your reaction to that? What's in between that? Do you allow the experience of this moment to create happiness or misery in your mind? And it can be done, no matter what you're feeling, to say, joy at last, there's no happiness in the world. To be able to let go of those things. And when in that letting go of those things, there is the deeper happiness, there is the freedom, there is the peace. It's a peace born of letting go. You don't allow the world to control that. You don't allow things which come and go to control that. You don't allow things which are beyond stability to actually to control that. When you let go, then you really have that peace, you really have that happiness. So that is a teaching which doesn't just apply when you're sitting or when you're in deep samadhi. That's a sort of a way of looking, a way of practicing, which you use at all times of your monastic life. How often is it that we get disappointed, fed up, upset? Why do you do that? Does it help at all? What's its effect? Sometimes its effect is that it takes away your energy, you get dispirited, you lose your encouragement, all your inspiration vanishes, you waste a lot of time, your energy goes. So the wise person, the person who starts to develop that insight and puts it into practice, realize all these things, they're not me, they're not mine, not a self. Whether it's the things of this monastery, whether it's the things of the world, whether it's things of the body or things of a mind. All these things which arise and pass away in your mind, are they you? Can you control them? Nothing to do with you. So why allow them to control your happiness? It's another way of saying, why attach to them? Why sort of make that connection that this is important to you? And then if we can let that go, then whatever happens in the mind, it's abandoned, it's let go of. It's not so much that one develops an equanimity, because it's one abides in the pleasure of equanimity, which is the other happiness. The happiness which comes when we really do abandon, let go of every other thing. And as we develop that in our ordinary life, it tends to actually to strengthen our ability to let go of all sorts of things. All of that obstructions, hindrances which lie between the knower and the known get weakened and weakened in the ordinary practice of our monastic life. And as they get weakened and weakened, just as we less and less are concerned and worried about the things of the world or the things of our body or the things of our mind, we get less and less worried and concerned about these things. We don't allow them to control our happiness. We dwell, as they say, more independent in this world. Independent of the things which rise and fall, which come and go. That should be our goal. And of course the result of that, as we get more independence from the seasons of the world, from the health and sickness of our body, as we get more independence from the moods and energy states of our mind, there we find this beautiful sense of stillness, the ability to let go, which, when the situations are ripe, we can actually turn into very deep samadhi. Because the very same attitude of mind, of disassociating, letting go of doing, letting go of controlling, letting go of judging, sort of being independent of what's coming and going in the mind. Independent means the result of a letting go, of unshackling the mind. The more we do this, just the more deep in our samadhi we get. The more deep in our samadhi, then the easier it is to let go in the world. And the more we let go in the world, the deeper samadhi comes. And so it becomes a path of insight and calm, all coming together. So it's a way of letting go in the world as well. And I have just mentioned this because, you know, sometimes as an abbot, you're not just a meditation teacher, but you've got to keep the monastery rolling along. And ordinary daily life, and monks or novices, anagarikas, getting upset at each other, and really not realizing that whatever anybody says, that's for you, that's the known. And you're the person who knows this. And why do you allow that to upset you? Why do you make that connection of mine? I heard that, they're talking about me, or whatever else it is. As soon as you make that connection, then you get caught up. You have suffering. You're allowing the world to control your happiness. Even the thoughts which come up in your mind, why allow the thoughts to control your happiness? Thoughts come, thoughts go. When you have that attitude, I don't care what those thoughts are, they can say this, they can do that. When you let them go, then they tend to stop. It's just like when somebody shouts at you, or they scream at you, or they call you a dog, or whatever else it is. When you don't pay attention, well, I'm not going to allow you to control my happiness, they give up playing those sorts of games with you. It's the same with the thoughts. When you don't pay that importance to the thoughts which arise and pass away in your mind, you don't allow them to control your happiness. They're just thoughts, that's all. Then you can be independent of those thoughts. And what happens as a natural result, just like the person who's trying to upset you, just leaves you alone. If you don't give them that power, if you ignore them, if you say, I'm not going to allow you to control my happiness. If the same way, when you say that to the thoughts just leave you alone. In other words, the thoughts calm down and disappear. You get more silence in the mind. Reason is because the thoughts are no longer important. How many of you are controlled by your thoughts? How many of you are sort of so caught up in that thinking that they can send you to another monastery, they can send you over here, they can send you into fantasies, they can send you into sex, they can send you into all sorts of stuff? Why do you allow those thoughts to sometimes make you happy as you're so joyful? Because you had some nice thoughts. Why is it that sometimes they make you so depressed? It's the connection between the knower and the thinking. It's the allowing them to control you. And this is one way of being independent from them. I'll not allow you, thinking, to control my inner happiness. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to be happy no matter what goes on in my mind. So letting go of living independent. And you can actually say that because that particular attitude, it does unlock something. It does untie a bond. It does actually separate you from the what arises and passes away in your mind. It's an insight which starts to work. Even as you go deeper in the meditations, when you're watching the breath, coarse breath, long breath, short breath, fine breath or whatever, I'm not going to allow you to control my happiness. I'm not going to get excited when it starts to work. I'm not going to get disappointed and frustrated when it doesn't seem to be working for me. So many people in the monastery here, when they're meditating on the breath, they get frustrated. It's not working. What they are doing there is allowing sort of their meditation to control their happiness again. They're not letting go. They're demanding something. They're wanting something, saying that if I get peaceful, then I'll be happy. And of course, you know, that's not letting go, and that's one of the reasons why people have obstacles to the meditation path. that letting go business. It's a difficult thing to do, but this is one way of doing it. One aspect. One of the other aspects I was teaching people during the interviews was, now just imagine you're driving this car and you take your hand off the steering wheel, take your feet off the pedals. That's fearsome sometimes. The reason it's fearsome is because you're letting go of control. And the whole idea of control is coming mainly from fear. If I don't do this, something will go wrong. I will get hurt. You find out in meditation that if you don't give up control, then you get hurt. After a while, you give up fear. You're really willing to let go that much. Imagine you're in a car. And if I was in a car sitting next to Amandus, and Amandus did that, actually he does that now, he takes his feet off the pedals, because it's cruise control. But he doesn't take his hands off the steering wheel, thank goodness. But that's actually what's happening in your meditation. You're actually taking the hands off the steering wheel as well. And everything goes just fine. You don't crash, nothing goes wrong. Even if it did, so what? You're having that degree of letting go. You're not allowing anything to control you or to control this mind, this knower. If you can do that, what's actually happening, it's a brilliant way of abandoning and letting go. When a beautiful breath comes up or a nimitta, you literally take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. Sometimes I imagine that in the meditation, because it's just a way of putting into a visual format something which the mind does. It lets go, it abandons. No matter what happens, I'm not going to allow this meditation to control me. If it happens, fine. If it doesn't happen, fine. That way, I've got no vested interest, no craving, no attachment there. And of course, then, it happens. And actually you learn just the way into the samadhi when you give up the search for happiness or controlling happiness, and all the happiness in the world comes as once you let go of the search, then you find the treasure. And not only that, but then at the end of the meditation, when one comes out of those deep meditations, one always reflects just what happened. The more one let go, the more one took away the power of the world. The world has only got the power you give it. And the power to make you unhappy, the power to make you happy, the power to give you tears or smiles. You give the world that power, you give the body that power. You even give the mind that power as well, to make you unhappy or to make you sad. That's why the enlightened ones, they've stopped giving that the world power anymore. They're happy despite what happens. This is a peace, a happiness, a freedom, of disentangling yourself from the world. But of course, one can only do this, you know, with that, you know, confidence, that little insight which keeps on coming up, of actually seeing what's really going on, seeing, you know, what do we really mean by I'm not going to allow the world or the body or the mind to control my happiness. What do we really mean by that? And it has to look so deeply and so powerfully with this mindfulness, and have this mindfulness so powerful and so free that it's, as I was telling one of the people in the interviews, it's not seeing what you want to see. It's not sort of denying what you can't see. It's like a mindfulness which is free from the coarsest of those five hindrances, and eventually free completely from those five hindrances. To be free from the coarse part of those five hindrances, especially the first two, is actually being more accurate to what you see. It's basic psychology of, you know, wishful thinking or denial, which actually bends the truth of what one's experiencing. And that's why that, you know, I often say that the trying to find insight when those two hindrances are still active is just not seeing things as they truly are at all. You're just seeing things as you expect them to be or you want them to be because of the first hindrance of sensory desire. Or you're just blocking out what you don't want to see, what you're afraid to see, what challenges you out of the second hindrance of ill will, of denial. That's what we really mean by this vipalasa, this perversion of the cognitive process of view, perception and thought. The whole cognitive process being distorted is what's meant by delusion, the avijja, the root cause of suffering. We all think we're right. Why is that? Because I perceive it's right. Your views condition your perception conditions your thoughts, and your thoughts reinforce your views. And everyone has got a different set of views, perceptions and thoughts. We all think that we are right. And the point is that that's called delusion. And delusion is what you cannot see. You don't know you're deluded. Everyone thinks they're wise. The only way you can break that cycle is actually to block out this wishful thinking or this denial. To be so still that there's no restless. You can see things long enough to pick up the information. Have clarity. There's not this dullness of the mind through sloth and torpor. Not doubting yet. You're just gathering the information. It's not the time to doubt. Just to see first. Five hindrances are gone. Then insight really happens. And the more the five hindrances are gone, the more you can trust that insight. That's why that, you know, the insight which happens when the five hindrances are weakened is still valid enough to get you deeper in your meditation. To be able to let go more and more, to abandon more and more, to not allow the world to control your happiness. Not allow your body to control your happiness. Sometimes people think when they're sick they can't meditate. They're just too tired. The saying in the suttas, oh, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too early, it's too late. And people like that will never get into deep meditation. And personally, I've tried that out sometimes, being very, very sick and meditating, and it works. You can get into the deepest of states of meditation when you've got a very, very sick body, even when you've got fever. You can do that when you're tired. You can still get deep meditation. At any time, any place, you can let go of this body. It doesn't matter what the body is doing. Sometimes it takes more skill. That's the only difference, but it can be done. What that really, really means, you know, is that one, through that insight, one realizes that even though the body is sick, the mind can still be free. One can sort of let go. And when one understands this and learns this, now it's like an insight, this body is important, but it's not insurmountable. And so what that really means is that when one meditates, one can say, I won't allow this body to stop me meditating, no matter what it's doing. If you want to, you can. Body, I'm not going to allow you to control my meditation. You're disentangling from the body. Even actually seeing that through experience is very, very powerful, because it shows you just how much that we give in to our bodies. We've got to care for our body, look after it, but sometimes we can give in too much. Not forcing the body, not controlling it, but literally just ignoring it, letting it go, disentangling our mind from the body. When one can see that, we can only see that for, you know, when the hindrances get weakened. They're not completely gone yet. When they get weakened, one can actually see that's possible. That's what insights are. Insights are things which free you, which liberate you from the attachments which cause suffering. Insights are what take away burdens from your back, which give you more lightness and freedom in this world, and in your world of the mind as well. So as one develops these insights, one gets more and more freedom. The hindrances get weakened and weakened and weakened. And it's when they get fully weakened, then this whole connection between views, perceptions and thoughts can be finally broken. That connection there is as if that instead of your perceptions being always bent by your views and your thoughts, always seeing things in the same old ways, there comes a time when the mind becomes so still and so inspired, so full of energy, so penetrating. You see things in a different way. And that's what real insight means. seeing things in a way you've never seen before. Especially seeing in terms of, you know, the characteristics of impermanence, suffering, non-self, and, I'm going to add, emptiness. Seeing those things, people think, oh yeah, I know what they are. You don't. If you did, you can put your hand up and say, I'm enlightened. Why can't we see those things? It's because we're just seeing those things, we're perceiving them according to our old views, our conditioning. We can't decide to break that as an act of will. It's broken through weakening the five hindrances. I'll say those things again, the five hindrances. The karma chanda, or sometimes in the suttas, lokeya bija, which is the realm of the five senses, having sort of preferences there, desires for this and not that. It's basically the desire, because most people only know that world, all of their desires are focused in that realm. And it's actually what bends the truth to make you see what you want to see, what creates happiness, joy, pleasure in that realm of the five senses, even what gives a sense of satisfaction or peace in the realm of that five senses. That's the desire for the world of the five senses, for the body, for this planet Earth, whatever else it is, for the monastery. That's what bends the truth. You have to let go of that completely. Let go of concern from the body. Body, you can just do whatever you like. I will not allow you to control my happiness. World, I won't allow you to control my happiness. That's the ending, temporarily, of karma chanda. The same as ill will, I won't allow you to make me unhappy. The ill will, which again just denies the truth because it's too unpleasant. It's an aversion towards truth, which is psychologists can see as denial. That has to be abandoned to break this views, perceptions, thoughts, vicious cycle. And the restlessness, it stops you actually. Sometimes you can have abandoned sensory desire and ill will. But, you know, you've still got the resultant restlessness of the mind. You know, from previous sensory desire and ill will. And what that means is the mind is not still enough to stay with one thing long enough to actually to truly understand it. A lot of time it's restlessness and ill will, a lot of times sensory desire and ill will cause that restlessness. But here I'm saying this is like the result, the echo, the fact that you've dropped the ball and it's bouncing now, the ball of your mind in restlessness. And of course you can never really understand things unless you stay long enough with it to allow the mind to penetrate and see it in its fullness. And of course the sloth and torpor is the mind is just too dull. You can't pick up much of what's going on. They say the mind is contracted in the Pali. And of course the doubt is the mind again never being still enough. Always is thinking popping up, not allowing the silence and the stillness, time, to teach you what the Dhamma truly is. And when that happens, when those five hindrances are gone, then of course the whatever fear comes up of seeing things which you don't want to see, whatever denial which usually blocks you, whatever wishful thinking is not there anymore. It's only at such a time you can truly see things as they really are. Not as you want them to be, not as you expected them to be, not as you've always been taught that they are. It's only at that particular opportunity can real insight come up. Problem comes that sometimes that insight, when it comes up, can be just so challenging that either ill will or doubt can actually pop up so quickly. You're seeing something, but it can't be true. That's doubt. You're seeing something, but I don't want to see this. You're seeing something, but I want to see something else. Those hindrances can come up so quickly and they can stop the enlightenment experiencing really developing. As if like Mara gets in at the last minute and stops you. but with the hindrances which have been overcome after jhana. The hindrances which have not just been overcome for a short time, which have been so powerfully suppressed that it takes huge amount of time before they come up again. That's why the post-jhana experiences, when the hindrances have been so suppressed, it takes a long time for them to interfere again. That's a time when even if you're seeing something you don't want, well, you usually wouldn't like to see, just that ill will hindrances is just, it's just too unconscious, too knocked out, too suppressed to actually to interfere. Sensory desire is just can't come up because you're already blissed out, you don't need any enjoyment of the five senses. You've got enough power to hold the mind, restlessness just can't move you. Sloth and torpor after a decent meditation is gone for a long time. The mind is still. Doubt doesn't come. It's only at such a time you have the opportunity to see things in a different way. A different way than you've ever seen them before. What would normally be shocking, what normally be something which was so different that normally the mind would not be able to see it. Now you can see. Fear, which will normally come up, of seeing that you don't exist. There's no control, there's no being in here. Just the inability just to see the whole of samsara being dukkha. Just the idea conditioned into us. At least there must be some little place where there's sukha for me. Some little place which I can keep for myself. Some little heaven realm. To see the whole of samsara as this. You can't do that unless the five hindrances are completely gone. It's just too horrible to see just the amount of suffering there is in here. And of course it's just too untenable to see just the amazing amount of impermanence. That's why sometimes when people actually experience an insight into impermanence, that things are fading away so quickly. And it's like many have had that experience, like you're standing on something which is falling all the time. You can't find any place to stand, to rest, even for a second, for a millisecond. Just the whole world is just completely disintegrating every moment. This is like meditation experiences I'm describing. And sometimes when those hindrances aren't fully overcome, if it's a pre-jhana insight, then fear comes up just too quickly and you can't continue. So the insight journey. But after the jhana, those hindrances of fear just doesn't come up. You're blissed out, you're powerful, you're still. What would normally just really scare you to the core, now just... it's just there, it's just truth, that's all. And there you allow these insights to unfold. And there the insights unfold one after the other, without moving the mind into fear, into rejection. There the insights of enlightenment can occur. That's why it's so important to lessen those five hindrances. One lessens them in the beginning, just with simple insights. And as one pursues this path, the insights lead to calm, and the calm leads to more insights, and the insights lead to a deeper calm. The function of insight is to see where you're clinging on to things, and to untie that knot. The function of insight is to create calm, and the function of calm is to prepare the mind for deeper insights. To be so still, so withdrawn from those five hindrances, that you can see things you'd normally reject. And that way, that whole cycle of vipalasas, the perversions of view, perceptions and thoughts become broken. Not only do you see things the way they truly are in the world, the word of the Buddha, that's just seeing each one of those five khandhas is not me, not mine, not a self, nor is there a me or mine or self apart from those five khandhas, not contained in them, not part of them, not owning them. To cease of non-self completely. That's what the Buddha meant as yathā-bhūta-yāna-dasana. To see things as they truly are. And that was the experience of the stream winner. To see that all the bodies, not me, not mine, not a self, the Vedana just comes and it just goes. You don't allow even Vedana to control your happiness. Sounds a bit of a contradiction, but that's pretty accurate. You know, the pleasure and pain, or in between, and the six senses, that's irrelevant now. That doesn't control happiness. It's a happiness which is beyond those six senses. And in the perceptions, thoughts, will, even conscious moments, doesn't control your happiness anymore. You see that none of that is me, mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to me. Nor is there any self outside of those, containing them, or whatever. It's all gone. To be able to see that is what the Buddha meant as yathā-bhūta-yāna-dasana, seeing things as they truly are. When that's seen for what it is, that's the attainment of stream winner, seeing things as they truly are. And the result of that is the virāga, the fading away, the cessation. From that moment of seeing, those whipalas of business starts to unwind. Views, perceptions, thoughts. First of all, the views are purified. You see things as they truly are. But don't think that you'll always have right view in every moment, because, well, yeah, you do, sorry. You do have right view in every moment, but sometimes your perceptions and thoughts, those perceptions and thoughts which arise in the mind after stream winning, are not always coming from the right view of that event. One still has the perceptions and thoughts which are arising from the views prior to that attainment, conditioned by those views, not the view of the stream winner. And that is why, even though the stream winner would have perfect right view, sometimes there can be perceptions and thoughts, a sensory desire or ill will, worldly thoughts, worldly perceptions. But the view would always be straight. And it's only a matter of time before those old perceptions, those old thoughts, based on the past before the stream winning attainment, it's only a time before they all fade away. And one's perceptions and thoughts become in line with the Dhamma one has seen, with the right view. This is where those vipalasas work. First view is straightened out, and then over a matter of at most seven lifetimes, the perceptions and thoughts come into line. When those perceptions and thoughts come into line with one's right view, one can never even think in terms of a self, in terms of a me, in terms of a mine. One can never even perceive that way. Because one never perceives that way, one's mindfulness is constant, it's pure. It's pure in the sense that it always knows and sees non-self. It always sees in terms, there's no one here. Always sees and perceives in terms of there's no happiness to be found in this world. And it's just dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. And of course, once that happens, then that's called the attainment of the arahat. You've purified the mind. Purify the mind of its wrong view, first of all. And then purify the mind as a consequence of that, of its wrong perceptions and wrong thoughts. That's actually the job of insight. So the real insight, the dasana, is actually what one gets at stream winning. And from then on it's bhavana, the development. Dasana is like the seeing of what's going on. The seeing which comes from the hindrances being abandoned, and seeing what the Buddha saw, seeing the emptiness of a self. And then from that seeing, the one develops that path, bhavana. It just happens naturally. The perceptions and thoughts eventually just come into line. When that bhavana is completed, the whole process, the cognitive process of views, perceptions and thoughts are straightened out. That's called the end of avijja. When the avijja is ended, the end of delusion, then there's nothing to give rise to birth anymore. Then you can actually say that birth is ended, done is what needs to be done. So this is what insight is. Insight is so crucial for the stream winner. But then afterwards, insight has basically done its job. Now it's a job for bhavana, for development. That's why there's, I think, one sutta in the Anguttara Fours, where it says that, I think Ananda says, everyone who comes and claims enlightenment in his presence, they always say they claimed enlightenment in one of four ways. Either they developed, I may get the order wrong, samatha first, then vipassana, until the path became clear. I take that as meaning the attainment of stream winning. And then they developed that path, and that was until the point of arahat. Or they did insight first, and then samatha, until the path became clear. Or they did it together, until the path became clear, and then they made much of that path. Or they say it seemed to be, I think from listening to a sutta, the five hindrances were abandoned, and the path became clear, and then they developed that path to the point of arahat. But it seems it's always the same way. It's the stream winning and then development, the insight, the abandoning of the five hindrances is the stream winning attainment. And I mentioned in the talk today how important it is to abandon those five hindrances almost completely, to really see. Maybe in the time of the Buddha, with the power of a Buddha's sermon, those five hindrances could have been abandoned for a long time, even without a jhana. But certainly afterwards, making much of the path would have included those jhanas. This is actually how insight works, and what insight truly is, and what delusion, avijja, is, and what the end of delusion is, using the Buddha's idea of the vipalasas, but also starting off from just a simple statement of not allowing anything to control your happiness, living independent even at the beginning of the process as much as you can, until you're truly independent of the five khandhas, the six sense bases, truly independent of anything in the world. And may that be your attainment in this lifetime.
Sukhati Kano